This is part two of my two-part series on inner gold. Is anybody here who was not here yesterday? Okay, hopefully it'll make sense, Gail. But first, a side note. I was thinking about the line in the Dogen that we chanted this morning, the Fukan Zazengi text, Guidelines for Zazen Text. And maybe you've noticed, but he does a big, long section, very particular, about the posture of the body. And then a very sort of scanty little half line about what to do with your mind. And I was thinking, you know, we pay attention to our mind and our body in probably the reverse proportion of what he's suggesting. Have you noticed that? You know, we're always worrying about our mind, and the body is sort of baggage, you know. So I was thinking about particularly the line of aligning your ears with your shoulders, and I think like many of us, I tend to hunch forward a little bit. And when I injured my shoulder, the orthopedic surgeon explained that when we hunch our shoulders forward long enough, the ligaments in the front get shorter and the ones in the back get longer, so it's not like so easy to, so we can't force anything, you know, we got the body we have. But recently I've been really enjoying the internal action of just gently lifting the sternum. You might try that now. Just a real gentle kind of, like a string is coming up at a little angle like this. And what I experienced, and don't force anything, is that allows for some openness, the shoulders drop, and then there's a little more room for the neck and head. So anyway, next time you read that complicated thing, maybe just lift your sternum a little bit. And breathe and let go. I'm a recovered posture fanatic myself, and I created a lot of pain in the body earlier on, trying to make the body that I have into some ideal version of the Zen body. So that doesn't work. But maybe we could... A little bit. It'd be nice, huh? Spacious, you know? All the time, you know, standing. So the Shashu posture is also supportive of this, walking around the Zendo. Open and awake. Side note number two. I mentioned being a bit of a disciple as well, as well as being a disciple of Shakyamuni Buddha, why we're here today. I've become a bit of a disciple of the Science Buddha. So I thought I'd read you an excerpt from the teachings of the Science Buddha. You might find this interesting. A small section from the paper, The Neuroscience of Mindfulness Meditation, written by Yiyuan Tong of Texas Tech University, Britta Holzel of the University of Munich, and Michael Posner of the University of Oregon. Who knows how they know each other? The section's called Neural Mechanisms of Enhanced Attentional Control. Several functional and structural MRI studies on mindfulness training have investigated neuroplasticity in brain regions supporting attention regulation. The brain region to which the effects of mindfulness training on attention is most consistently linked is the anterior cingulate cortex. The anterior cingulate cortex enables executive attention and control by detecting the presence of conflicts emerging from incompatible streams of information processing. The ACC and the frontoinsular cortex form part of a network that facilitates cognitive processing through long-range connections to other brain areas. Cross-sectional studies have reported enhanced activation of regions of the ACC in experienced meditators compared to controls during focused attention generation, or when mindfully anticipating delivery of painful stimulus. Think about that for a minute, yeah. You're about to get shocked by the experimenters and they monitor your brain and see what happens. It's a heat, actually it's a heat stimulus. They put this hot thing in your leg. Greater activation of the ventral and or rostral anterior cingulate cortex during the resting state following 5 days of a meditation training were also found in an actively controlled randomized longitudinal study. Although ACC activation may be enhanced in earlier stages of mindfulness meditation, it might decrease with higher levels of expertise as demonstrated in a cross-sectional study. And this is referring to lots of studies. There's all kinds of citations. Structural MRI data suggest that mindfulness meditation might be associated with greater cortical thickness and might lead to enhanced white matter integrity in the anterior cingulate cortex. So function and structure of this part of your brain seem to change through meditation. Although there is evidence that brain regions relevant for the regulation of attention show functional and structural changes following mindfulness meditation practice, it is not yet determined whether these changes are actually related to improved attentional performance. So, there you have it. Science, the science Buddha says meditation works, but we don't know what it works for, or how it works, or what you get out of it. But if your goal is to have increased white matter integrity in your anterior cingulate cortex, you're in the right place. And this is great because haven't you always gone to these meditation retreats and then your spouse or your friends or somebody asks you, well, how was it? What did you learn? And you have no idea really what to say, right? You know? And so now you know. You could say that you believe you've seen some structural and neuroplastic changes in your ACC. So it's been a delight. As Norman mentioned, he's over in one room and I'm over another, and I'm feeling a similar experience of delight and gratitude and honor. Getting to hear a little bit about what people are thinking about and feeling and you know, living in their practice, in your practice. And it is so remarkable, isn't it, that somehow we received this particular way of being together, this particular practice, and we just use practice, we throw that word around without knowing what it is any more than we know what the anterior cingulate cortex is doing. But we need a shorthand for something bigger than any word, so we say practice. But somehow this practice, throw the air quotes around it if you want, really does something. Something happens. Does it do it? Do we do it? Do we do it together? Do we do it individually? And a few of you were kind enough to share your responses to this topic of the Jungian gold transfer theory as presented by Robert A. Johnson. In some cases, just how perfectly, brilliantly it matches your experience and how and sort of illuminating it seems to be. In other cases, how it doesn't seem to match experience at all, but sort of contemplating it and thinking about it and being introduced to these ideas and noticing one's responses illuminates your reality in some other way. Some other model seems more apt. And of course, I'm not claiming this to be right or the truth or anything to be right or the truth. Models, words, concepts to help us try to understand something called human life, which is a bigger matter than 1,000 Buddhist sutras or science studies or Jungian texts. But it struck me so strongly that I decided to have faith in my response that it would be worth 2 talks at the Sesshin to explore Robert A. Johnson's thought and reflect on it a little bit. And that was risky. I wasn't so sure, you know, if I should be doing that. You know, safer to crack open a little Dogen or something. You know, you're in a funny place when it seems safer to crack open a little Dogen. But let's continue anyway. Sometimes the exchange of gold doesn't go so well. We had a few examples yesterday of beautiful exchanges of this inner alchemical gold. This idea that you see in someone else what you're about to realize, what you're longing to be or what you already are but can't yet recognize. And this is not unlike one set of Buddhist teachings, the Tathagatagarbha teachings, and there's only a couple of extant sutras, or maybe there's only a few in English. But there's an idea in Mahayana Buddhism of the Buddha nature being covered up, being hidden. And sometimes I like to talk about that. They have wonderful imagery around this, that the Buddha nature is like treasure buried under your floor that you forgot was there, or it's like a jewel wrapped in shit, and actually says that, along the side of the road, you know. But somehow you, after enough practice, you think of picking it up and looking at it. So this inner gold, but the exchange doesn't always go well. Sometimes we have to struggle, he says. When the exchange of gold proceeds well, we mature and eventually become strong enough to ask for our gold back. It might be awkward at first. We might have to slam the door as we exit to convince ourselves that we're leaving. We act in this kind of adolescent way, clumsy at retrieving our gold, because we don't really understand what's going on. Carrying someone's gold is a fine art and a high responsibility. If you are the recipient of someone's gold, hold it carefully and be prepared to give it back within a microsecond's notice. Unfortunately, there are people who collect gold and refuse to give it back. It's a kind of murder. You know, he chooses his words carefully, this guy, so it's a kind of murder. They collect an entourage or followers and exploit them. It happened to me, and it was exceedingly painful. My father didn't really father me, and so much of the fatherly gold in me was uninvested. I spent a good part of my early life looking for the father I never had. One day when I was in my 20s, a man came into my life who seemed ideal for this investment of gold. He acted like a father, and let it be known that he would carry the masculine archetype for me. I trusted him and was ready for a wise, older man to guide me to the next stage of life. Here was someone in whose glory I could bask. I gave him my gold, and it was a wonderful experience for a few days. Within a week, he began manipulating and dominating me, organizing my life and using me. I could have stayed, and that would have been the price for storing my fatherly gold with him. But I already knew too much to allow him to keep it. So I asked for my gold back. He wouldn't return it. He wanted to continue the manipulation. I had to fight with him, not with blows, but psychologically. I fought my way out of his orbit, and there is still enmity between us. It was a bitter experience. Our culture understands little about these matters. So when we ask the other person for our gold back, she probably won't know what we're talking about. She might say, last week you were opening doors for me and treating me like a princess, and this week you're ignoring me. People don't understand the dynamics. It's only after you get your gold back that you see the gold of the other person. When the time is right, when you're ready to bear the weight, you must get your gold back. If you can do it with dignity and tact, that's best. But you must get it back, one way or another. So there's an interesting permission there to struggle, isn't there? You must get your gold back. Don't mix levels. When gold is being exchanged, there are two rules that can save both parties trouble. First, when you put your gold onto someone, you have no right to pester that person. You heard that, right? When you put your gold on someone, you have no right to pester that person. To project meaning and importance onto another person is enough. You don't want to smother him or her. Second, don't mix levels. This is a powerful idea, I think. Don't mix levels. Alchemical gold is an element in its own right and shouldn't be mixed with anything else. Friendship, companionship, sex, fun, work, all these relationships can be good, but but it creates a mess when you express the alchemical gold through them. You may end up marrying the person who carries your gold. That's legitimate, but don't mix the gold with the many other facets of relationship that are possible. Blessed are the pure in heart. Pure means unmixed. On what level is it true? On what level is the virgin birth true? Almost all psychological suffering is caused by mixing levels. Almost all psychological suffering is caused by mixing levels. Everything in you is good in its own right, a construct of God. But contamination of one thing by another can short-circuit both. Much of my time as a therapist was spent making an effort to get patients to state as simply as possible the elements of their problem. As soon as the issues are understood clearly, it's usually clear what to do. When you are struck, when gold is being exchanged, sit quietly till the smoke clears and you see where you are. If you can talk this out with the person holding your gold, with all the dignity and intelligence you can muster, it's a beautiful way of affirming what's going on. It may be risky, but it's well worth the effort. One problem we might have is we don't notice that someone else is giving us their inner gold. I co-led a mindfulness retreat one time with someone else, another person I didn't know terribly well. And the other person was a student in a different Buddhist lineage, and we were trying to get together and express something about Buddhism and how it shows up in this mindfulness movement. And it was interesting, we're trying to sort of be equals, but I was certainly more experienced, so there was already a little power dynamic there that maybe I could have been more careful about. Well, I could have been. And soon my co-leader was asking me lots of questions about my training and how I came to be a teacher in this tradition. At first I thought he was just curious, you know, from another Buddhist tradition. But later I started to realize there was a lot of personal freight and a lot of implied sort of compliments and even awe of me in our conversation, with also a mixed-in request to be equals. My co-leader, I now feel, was giving me gold. I was looking for me to give it right back by reassuring him that he was a good retreat teacher and a good person. And one of the things I've noticed about myself is I don't remember to do reassurance by default. I just don't think of it. I don't know, maybe it's my part of the training we have here to be quiet. Maybe I'm shy. Maybe I just assume everything and everyone is fine, unless they tell me otherwise, and I have a bit of a blindness there, you have to tell me pretty loud. Maybe you've noticed that. I miss big hints sometimes that the other person isn't fine or is offended by something I did and is just trying to keep it together. And maybe this tendency I seem to have is not the best match for our passive-aggressive Northwest culture, where we don't usually say right away that we're upset with somebody. We have to chew on it for a while and be nice. Anyway, I just wasn't getting it. You know, I just wasn't getting it. I thought everything was basically fine. The retreat was going well. You know, I was making decent effort to stay in collaboration and connection and communication with my co-leader. And then at the end of the retreat, I made a mistake. My co-leader had expressed a preference about how the close of the retreat would go and the cleanup of the facility would go, and I just completely forgot his request. I got focused on, you don't need all the details, but I got focused on sort of getting it done, which is another thing about me, but anyway. And I asked my co-leader to do something he had expressly asked me not to do. And he was not able to say anything about it in that moment. Wasn't able to say, well, wait a minute, we agreed, you know, I wouldn't do this. He just got angry, actually, really angry. I was really astounded and surprised, blown away. And of course, I got defensive. Why didn't you just say so? You know, just remind me. I'm not perfect here. But now I'm realizing, possibly, if I think about this model, that he had given me so much gold, he was too vulnerable. And I had received his gold without noticing I was receiving it and had not given it back to him. And in fact, I'd acted like I didn't even have it. And from his point of view, I threw his gold in the mud and stomped on it. Very painful. Very embarrassing to be so unskillful. And so easy to blame my co-leader for taking something personally that wasn't personal. Just trying to get this task done. Just busy thing, a really busy thing running a retreat. You can't keep anything in your head, right? Yeah. Anyway, so what I noticed, though, is that for me, this particular framework makes it easier for me to take responsibility, to be more careful and more kind, to be curious if someone is giving me their inner gold. And maybe overtly I say, no, thank you. You know, you don't need to give me your inner gold. Doesn't mean we always have to receive this or carry something for someone else or be some something for somebody. But it seems like a very real model for some of these kinds of exchanges, where something seems just totally cockamamie and not right from another framework, the framework I had at the time. Why are you taking it personally, framework? What's wrong with you? Turns out that doesn't help anybody tell them that. Doesn't straighten them out. And I've been training for a long time to try to get it through my head that you can't really straighten anybody out. And I feel like I'm maybe halfway there. And here's a positive gold story. Sometimes it does go well. A woman came to Bellingham for graduate school maybe about 10 years ago, started practice with us. Like, I think that's where she first did meditation. And to be honest, I remember her, but I don't remember a whole lot about her presence in the Sangha. You know, another person in the group, you know. But I found out later that this was a very important time for her. And it's clear now that she gave and received some powerful inner gold. Sporadically, over the years since, she's kept in touch with me on the email. A little update here about a new job, a relationship, publishing a book, that she found a Sangha where she lives now on the East Coast, that she's starting to study the precepts. All very nice, and each time one of these came, I tried harder to remember her, and, you know, visualize what she looked like and respond kindly, and it was nice. And then a couple of times she was in the area and was interested in getting together, but it kind of kept not working, and one time she was in the area for a month, and I actually kind of dropped the ball, forgot. And that made me really nervous. Like, uh-oh. Did I blow it? Am I letting down my side? But maybe it seemed like it was okay. But then finally she was in the area again, and we did meet. And the morning before I went to meet her, I read this little book by Robert Johnson. And I thought, this person is ready for me to give her back her inner gold. And this keeping in touch with me all these years was just kind of like keeping tabs on its whereabouts. You know? Like, Tim, is my gold still there? I'm saying, yes, your gold's still here. By just saying, yeah, nice to hear from you. And yeah, things are fine here. Yeah, Walker's 12 now. And, you know, song is fine. Good, yeah. And we had a very pleasant meeting. You know, no fireworks or deep expressions of, you know, emotional. Just a warm, connected meeting. Graceful. Graceful, warm meeting. And very soon afterwards, she sent me a little note saying how meaningful, the meeting was very meaningful to her, and that this surprised her. I think she used the word ambushed. It ambushed me how important it was to see you. And I was glad, you know, I was really glad that I could gracefully show up, you know, like I did show up, and give her her gold back. And who knows, you know, where the gold balance is now, and maybe it doesn't matter. And of course, the exchange of inner gold gets all mixed in with intimate relationships, too. He was starting to say a little bit about that. Here's a little more, Robert Johnson, about love and marriage and inner gold. Sometimes when you put your gold onto another person, he also puts his gold onto you. It gets complicated when the exchange of gold goes both ways. One of the contamination of levels that we make, and we're scarcely able to think otherwise, is that the exchange of gold inevitably means marriage. Marriage is good, and gold is good. They may go together nicely, but they're not synonymous. It can be a problem when we mix these things up. We think, I've fallen in love, we must go to bed. Maybe you will, but that's not synonymous with falling in love. In our culture, mutual projection is regarded as the prerequisite for marriage. He doesn't pull his punches, he tells us what he thinks. Mutual projection is the prerequisite, you know. We take for granted that we will marry the person we are in love with, in love in italics. But being in love is not enough to guarantee a successful marriage or any long-term relationship. If you weren't married, substitute that. When you fall in love, you feel overwhelmed with excitement. You've projected your gold, your deepest inner value, onto another person. You've given it to him or her to incubate for a while until you're ready for it back. And if the feeling is mutual, she has given her gold to you. He has given his gold to you. For the relationships to succeed, somewhere along the line, each of you has to take your gold back. Unfortunately, this is usually accompanied by disillusionment. You're not the knight I thought you were. You're not the princess when you wake up in the morning. And the gold comes clattering down by way of disappointment. If we could only understand that we put our gold in someone's lap for a period of time until we got stronger, and someday it will come to an end, that phase will come to an end. But we aren't always wise in this respect, and it's one of the most painful issues in our culture. 5 years later, when the relationship isn't working, we don't understand that it's time for us to withdraw our projection and actually relate to the other person as a real person. True marriage can only be based on human love, which is different from romantic love, different from being in love or in loveness. Romanticism is unique to the West and is a relatively new occurrence, only since the 12th century. Romantic love is not the basis for marriage or human life. Our marriage is fed by the capacity to love human to human. When we're in love, we put our gold, our expectations, on the other person, and this obliterates the other person. There is no real relatedness. Loving is a human faculty. We love someone for who that person is. We appreciate and feel a kinship and a closeness. Romantic love, on the other hand, is a kind of divine love. We deify the other person. We ask that person, without knowing it, to be the incarnation of God for us. Being in love is a deep religious experience. For many people, the only religious experience they'll ever have. The last chance God has to catch them. So I've recently had the honor to try to support a couple different sets of people after difficult breakups, which is an honor and a real challenge, as you know. And it seems like there are some huge debts and surpluses in the gold department after a breakup. And it seems like the most painful thing might be when one partner understands the situation as having given the other an incredible amount of gold, a vast hoard of gold, their entire heart, and that the other didn't notice or didn't see it that way, or did see it, but it wasn't gold to them. It was something more ordinary and matter-of-fact and to be expected and not special in any way. The gold is missed or cheapened, and there's so much suffering. And both will have the burden, will carry the burden feeling it and understanding it in different ways, the burden of an imbalanced exchange, maybe for a long time. So that's sad, really. Robert Johnson feels there's inherently a spiritual dimension to all this, and you're hearing him drop God in more and more as we advance through his chapter. So if the God language doesn't work, just do an inner translation that works for you. One reason we hesitate to carry our own gold is that it's dangerously close to God. Our gold has a godlike characteristic. It's difficult to bear the weight of it. I mean, it's like too bright, you know, too intense. In Indian culture, there's a time-honored custom that you have the right to go to another person, a man, a woman, a stranger, and ask him or her to be the incarnation of God for you. There are laws and customs governing this. If the person agrees to be the incarnation of God for you, you must never pester him and her. You must never put a heavy weight on her. It's weighty enough as it is. You must not engage in any other kind of relationship with that person. You don't become friends and you don't marry him. The person becomes like a patron saint for you. Jay Krishnamurti was a wonderful man. Remember, Robert Johnson studied with Krishnamurti younger in his life. And lots of people put lots of gold on him. One afternoon, he and I went for a walk in Ojai, California, and a little old lady was kneeling alongside the path. We just walked by, and she was just there kneeling. Later, he told me, "She has put the image of God on me. She knows what she's doing. She never talks or asks anything of me. But when I go for a walk, she somehow knows where I'm going to be, and she's always there." What was most touching was his attitude. If she needed this, he would do it. You know, he would accept it. God is out of his box. This may sound like a joke, but it's not. God is out of his box. In olden times, God lived in the tabernacle, on the altar of the Catholic Church, and the priest had the key. God was locked in, and the rest of us were locked out. But there was a safety in that. But now the box is broken, and God is loose. No one knows what to do about it. Interesting attitude, huh? I'd love to read a history 100 years from now to see what it is we're going to do. There are wondrous possibilities. But if we don't succeed, the consequences could be dreadful. God, Spirit, Buddha, is high voltage. And if you get more than you can stand, as I did in Calcutta one time, you need help immediately. We can't lock God up again. We can't put him back in the tabernacle. Let's see if I can. I lost track of the Calcutta story, which is pretty interesting. Here it is. I love India. And his bio says he spent a fair amount of time in India. But it can be challenging, sometimes even dreadful. During one visit, I nearly sank in the darkness. An Indian friend and I went to Calcutta. He wanted to see his father, who lived in a politically sensitive zone near the city where foreigners were not allowed. So I said, "Please go. I'll stay in Calcutta while you visit with your father." My friend tried to help get me a hotel, but there were no good ones available, so I ended up in a cheap motel in a dark part of town. Because he was so anxious to see his father, once he got me settled, I encouraged him to just go ahead and go. Within hours, a woman on the street thrust a dead baby in my hands. Children with amputated limbs poked their stumps into my ribs, begging for money, and lepers and corpses were in the street where I walked. It was too much, and I didn't know how to get away from it. Normally, I could just go to my room and hole up. As an introvert, that isn't difficult for me. But my room in that hotel had paper-thin walls, and someone was actively dying in the room on one side, people were screaming and fighting in the room on the other side, and there was a night-long political rally in the square outside the window. I couldn't take it. I had more than I could hold. I was falling to pieces. Gold comes in many varieties. Sometimes our gold is bright, other times it is heavy and difficult. And sometimes anything but golden. I had no friends and no telephone. I couldn't cope. And then I remembered the custom I'd witnessed with Krishnamurti. I needed to ask someone to be the incarnation of God for me, someone with whom I could share my burden. I went to a park nearby to look for a candidate. That's remarkable, isn't it, to think about, you know? Maybe some stranger could help me in a deep spiritual way right now. That's inspiring. I went to the park to look for a candidate. After standing still and observing many people for about 20 minutes, I selected a middle-aged man who was wearing traditional Indian garb. I felt a particular respect for him. He walked with great dignity. I continued to watch him closely. Finally, trembling, I went up to him and asked, "Sir, do you speak English?" "Yes." "Will you be the incarnation of God for me?" This was the second sentence I said to the man. And, God bless him, he said, "Yes." I told him who I was, how frightened and burdened I was feeling, and that I was unable to stand it. I poured out my misery, and he just listened without saying a word. Finally, I wound down and apologized for splashing it all over him. I felt so much better. I had my feet under me again. I thanked him, and then I asked, "And who are you?" He told me his name. I said, "Yes, and who are you?" He said, "I am a Roman Catholic priest." There are very few Catholic priests in India, and I picked one to be the incarnation of God for me. He had listened and heard and understood. We bowed to each other and went our separate ways. Because he did that for me, neither of us will ever be the same again. He did exactly what I needed with a grace and a dignity that lives with me to this day. Who knows, maybe would we have found a monk or Zen teacher? So anyway, I hope these ideas are useful to you in some way, either describing or shining light on some other way of thinking about this complex reality that we call relating to each other. And I hope this exchange of gold that we call Red Cedar Zen, this gold exchange, this counting house, who has more, who has less, we all have enough. We all don't have enough. I hope it can be one in which we're really willing, And I think we are. I think that's really deeply true and so moving, that we really are willing to hold each other's gold, whatever that means for us, and that we're willing to give it back to each other when that's what it's called for. And may we see the urge towards hero worship on the one hand, elevating someone else on the one hand, and the dismissal or lowering of someone else in our mind on the other hand, as projections of our heart, our wounded, bleeding, whole heart. See these powerful tendencies as something just under the surface, something we are getting ready to learn, so that we aren't a problem for each other exactly, but the embodiment of potential, right? And when we receive a difficult projection, when we're on the receiving end of all this, which we are sometimes, and we will be, may we be gracious and patient. And remember that it arises, from suffering, from misunderstanding, from our humanity. I mean, may we know that there's always gold there somewhere, in every, behind every pair of eyes, you know, in every beating heart. Whether they're a Sangha member or somebody who just wandered in literally off the street. And for the locals, remember we put a lot of effort, we were, I think, thinking about this without this particular language in mind when we created our clear communication process and our ethical guidelines, and so we should continue studying those and practicing with those and letting those support us when the suffering overwhelms one of our number and we lose track of this golden nature of Buddha, of God. We can crack that open and say, okay, what's step one again, you know? And for any of you for whom I've held your gold badly or disrespectfully or unknowingly, I apologize. I'm always trying to learn, and I'm grateful when you're courageous and clear with me, even if it's uncomfortable. And I don't mind when you tell me it's going well either. And I'll try to do the same. Well, let's close with a poem, huh? Little gadget to cooperate. Let's have another Wendell Berry. And remember that this gold is not just human gold. It's all species. I go among the trees and sit still. All my stirring becomes quiet around me like circles on water. My tasks lie in their places where I left them asleep like cattle. Then what is afraid of me comes and lives a while in my sight. What it fears in me leaves me, and the fear of me leaves it. It sings, and I hear its song. Then when I am afraid, then what I am afraid of comes, I live for a while in its sight. What I fear, oops, excuse me, I'm going to start over there. I think I just crossed up three stanzas. Let's start over. This is untitled. It's from a collection of writing he called Sabbath Poems. He had a practice for a while, I guess, or maybe always, I don't know, on the Sabbath, taking the Sabbath, you know, that's good, and writing a poem. So let's start over. I go among the trees and sit still. All my stirring becomes quiet around me like circles on water. My tasks lie in their places where I left them asleep like cattle. Then what is afraid of me comes and lives a while in my sight. What it fears in me leaves me, and the fear of me leaves it. It sings, and I hear its song. Then what I am afraid of comes. I live for a while in its sight. What I fear in it leaves it, and the fear of it leaves me. It sings, and I hear its song. After days of labor, mute in my consternations, I hear my song at last, and I sing it. As we sing, the day turns, the trees move. I hear my song at last, and as I sing it, as we sing, singing with fear, the day turns, the trees move. So, I appreciate that Norman remembered to mention his reading tomorrow, 4 o'clock at Village Books. I hope we can all go. And I want to mention another event, which is built into the Sesshin. But if you're not sitting in Sesshin, you're also welcome. We'll do a formal closing of our Sesshin and also our winter practice period with the Shosan ceremony, the Dharma question and answer ceremony at 11 tomorrow morning. And I will be honored to officiate, sit in the seat of giving and receiving gold with you. And it's a question, if you haven't seen it before, it's a question in which you bring forward some words. Usually we say a question, but that's a little narrow. It's an expression, really, some expression of that moment of Dharma, of heart. Usually it's in the form of a question, but it need not be something direct, something that is true in some way. And if that sounds like a ridiculous burden to try to come up with something like that, I want to just encourage you not to worry. And to trust that in those kind of situations, Buddha takes care of it, the inner gold takes care of it, God takes care of it, however you think about these things, your gut takes care of it, and the right words will come. Or, what I used to do when I was completely terrified by the ceremony, is I would just go up there and say, I have nothing to say. And that's great too. That's a good thing to say. But anyway, that we'll explain the details. Maybe Talos will remember it well enough to explain it. I hope so. I pray. I don't know if I can right now. So we'll get the logistics and the details we'll kind of go over tomorrow. But I just want to mention it so that you could just percolate. Not so much figure out or rehearse, but percolate a little bit if that's helpful to percolate. What's the root right now for me? Like what's the pith, you know? What's important? What should be expressed from my heart, from practice? And it's not so much that you're talking to me, but I'm just sitting in the seat so that we can bring something up together in Sangha, in community, in the center of the circle. And something emerges in the center. You know, something emerges much bigger than anything any of us could imagine. This is, I think, the heart of our practice. So, thanks. I could say thanks forever, but your knees are probably killing you. So we'll end now. Maybe I'll just add one more thanks. I want to thank Chris for taking such care of me. Sesshin's really been so touching. Thank you. I look forward to thanking everybody else later and for you having a chance to thank each other later. With words or with our sternum.